In one corner, we have a five-year Office 365 MVP who develops training material, drinks some Microsoft Kool-Aid, knows practically everything there is about Office 365, conducts podcasts, and does stand-up events in front of hundreds of people on behalf of Microsoft talking about Office 365. Please welcome Robert Crane. And then in the other corner, we have Troy Hunt. Another Microsoft MVP, this time an MVP for developer security, an international speaker on web security and the author of many top rating security courses on Pluralsight.
That is actually going to be a really good setup.
Oh, and did I mention they both seem to compete for the most number of times that they each write blog posts for their blog sites.
Absolutely, man.
This is a Need to Know podcast featuring Office 365, Azure, business productivity and more. From CIA Ops, this is your host, Robert Crane.
Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. My name is Robert Crane, and this is episode 94, and we're speaking with Troy Hunt about the Ashley Madison hack and how the technology behind Troy's Have I Been Pwned website was able to cope with the demands once the Ashley Madison issue basically flared up. So listen along, some great information there. But before we get into that, I'll just cover off a few bits of news. Now, if you're basically in the Office 365 space, you probably need to know that the E5 license is now available for sale. So the E5 will replace the E4 SKU over the next 12 months. Now, the E5 has everything that the E4 license had, but also now includes the cloud, PBX, meeting broadcast, Power BI Pro, Delve organizational analytics, the customer lockbox, the advanced email threat management, and a whole lot of other options there. So I'll put all the links to those features inside the blog post for this episode. You can take a look, but certainly a great amount of features that have been added and certainly something that you should have a look at, and especially if you're talking to customers, something that's really worthwhile with all those options. Now, what also has happened, we also have seen that Power BI has added a Bing content pack, so that will allow you to do Power BI dashboards around search terms. We've also seen that OneDrive for Business now has the ability, when you share a link, for that link to be expired, so you can set an expiry date on how long that link will remain shared automatically for you. Azure Backup is now able to back up servers, so it can back up things like Exchange, SQL, SharePoint, a lot of workloads that it never used to be able to. So again, some blog posts in there that I'll put up in the links. Have a look at those. Plenty of great new technology. Another interesting one is Microsoft Find Time. So this allows you to organize the best meeting time via a web style interface or an add-in to Outlook, and allows you to organize that within your Office 365 tenant, but also with external users as well. I've also been doing some presentations around the Enterprise Mobility Suite, and I will make those available on the web at my docs.com site. I'll put the link again to that in the show notes as well. Now, that basically wraps up the news for this episode. Now, don't forget, you can contact me and connect with me via Skype for Business. My address is admin@ciaops365.com. Always appreciate people giving iTunes reviews and whatnot, letting others know about what this podcast is all about. I'll also point you to my online training at www.ciaopsacademy.com. Lots of good stuff on Office 365, PowerShell, Azure, some great information there, all bundled up in some really handy courses for you. Of course, always looking for feedback and listener interaction. What topics do you want? What guests would work? And as usual, you can always let me know any questions or comments you've got via www.ciaops.com/contact. And now, without any further delay, let's get into our episode with Troy Hunt. Welcome along, Troy.
G'day, mate. Good to be here.
Troy's back with us again, our security MVP, and if you haven't seen his video about Mick Dundee versus the Indian scammers, I certainly recommend that. I think that's probably where we left off last time, but what we'll do is talk about some interesting stuff when it comes to web security and also Azure scaling. But before we get into that, what I thought I'd get our guest to do is just introduce himself and let everybody know who he is and what he does. So if you could do that for us, Troy, that'd be great.
Yeah, well, you put me on the spot now. Okay, so I am Troy Hunt. I am a plural site author, so I write a lot of online courses for those guys. I'm also a Microsoft MVP for developer security, and my job these days is mostly writing courses, doing training, and traveling around the world speaking to people. So
sounds like it's made in the shade. Next, you'll be telling me you actually live in on the Gold Coast.
Yeah, about that. And mind you, I am in the process of unpacking and actually getting life in order. But the plan is I'll go somewhere between study and pool and exotic locations, and that will be life, which sounds kind of nice.
Wow. Exactly. Well, it's great that you maintain a blog to let us know that all of that's happening. But speaking of that, probably what we want to start off with is basically, before we get into the meat and potatoes here, what I'd be interested to get you to let people know is basically this Have I Been Pwned site that you've set up, been running for a while. Just give us a bit of the background as to, you know, why you set it up, how you set it up, what's its purpose, and then we can set the scene from there.
Yeah, look, the idea of Have I Been Pwned, and I set this up about 2 years ago now, so looking around about October, November 2013, and this was at the time of the Adobe data breach. So Adobe had about 152 million accounts exposed. It was still the largest data breach where the data was dumped publicly. So that was a massive one. And what I found was I had been analyzing various data breaches and looking at patterns between them. And particularly things like patterns of individuals appearing across multiple breaches, the same individuals, and then looking at how their attributes could be combined to build some sort of interesting info. So you'd find someone with perhaps a hashed password in one data breach, and then in another data breach, such as Adobe, there'd be a plain text password hint, and you could start to sort of join some interesting dots. And I thought, hey, it'd be really interesting if I actually created a service where people could get a good sense of the scope of their exposure. So it starts to aggregate these data breaches. So that was part of the motivation, but the other part as well is I really wanted to do something cool with Azure. And I wanted to do something that wasn't Hello World, and it wasn't a hypothetical, this is a, you know, typical Contoso sort of thing. I wanted to build an actual app. And this was a good use case for it because, first of all, it was a valid, useful service. And second of all, it's big. So I kicked off with about 155 million accounts from breaches in there. There's now about 122 million. So it gave me some good engineering challenges in terms of how I built the service. And what I didn't realize at the time is that it would become massively popular. And that would also give me some good engineering challenges about how the whole thing scaled as well.
Yeah, so I think, it's a very interesting, like I said, use case, and I think, the reality of what the service that can provide is certainly great. So, obviously, the idea basically is you go in, plug in your email address, and then you can see whether your email address has been exposed in one of these breaches, and as we know, the breaches are continuing ongoing, so part of that for you is obviously loading that data, putting it in there, and allowing people to provide that service. But obviously, recently, one of the major breaches that has certainly made the headlines left, right, and center has been the Ashley Madison one. So basically, give us a bit of a timeline. So you've got your Have I Been Pwned, and then you're obviously looking to put the Ashley Madison data in there. What's sort of the timeline of what sort of happened when that sort of kicked in?
Yeah, so Ashley Madison, the timeline for that's kind of interesting because normally with the data breach, an incident happens and there's all the data and that's sort of it. And then some sort of turmoil and chaos ensues after that. But with Ashley Madison, the attackers back in July came out and said, we have your data and here's proof. And they delivered a few records, which gave us a very high degree of confidence that it was correct. And they said, look, it's easy. All you got to do is just shut down the service and we won't release the data. And if you don't shut down the service, we will. And of course, Ashley Madison were never going to shut it down. So it kept running. And then about a month later, we saw the dump. And we saw in total just over 30 million unique accounts appear in August. And that was kind of interesting because we see online extortion quite a bit. We see cases where Where the organisation doesn't pay. We saw the same thing with Domino's in France recently. We see other cases, sometimes that we learn about much later, where organisations do pay. So Nokia actually paid some millions of euros in order to recover private keys quite a few years ago, which is kind of interesting. But in this case, clearly they didn't pay. The data was dumped, and Ashley Madison hit the headlines in a way that I just haven't seen before. The interest was massive, I think in part because there were a lot of people in it, in part also because it's an interesting topic. It's the sort of salaciousness of online affairs sites. And that drove massive consumer interest in the breach and consequently also in Have I Been Pwned?
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing was, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Ashley Madison, when you registered, it didn't have basically a verification of the email address. So you could put anybody's email address in there and it would end up in the database.
Well, you know, this is interesting. And I literally had this conversation a couple of hours ago as well, and that it's true. You could sign up with Barack Obama or whoever you wanted to, and then that email address would exist in the database. Just like every other website. And this is the thing, because pretty much every website out there that has registration, I would say 90% plus, will allow you to register under any email address. Now, consequently, some may actually say, we're going to send you an email and we want you to verify your identity. But that doesn't change the fact that the email address is in the database, because it's sitting there normally with some sort of a token waiting for you to successfully receive the email, click on the link with the token and then match it up, thus proving that you did actually want to be there. But the email address still exists there. So whilst there was a lot of jumping up and down about that, and it is valid to say that an email address could be there for someone who didn't want it to be there, it was really, I think, a little bit of a beat up in terms of saying, well, these just shouldn't have been there, or, you know, this is an unusual thing, because it's not.
Okay. So I think that, you know, obviously there were, you know, high media visibility, and again, obviously hit the headlines, and they obviously didn't do the right thing, and, you know, obviously got the data dumped. So when that actually happened, again, you've written all of up this up, you know, quite in a lengthy blog post here, dated the 28th of August, which certainly recommend everybody to go and have a look at. So let's just start off with the technology side of it. I mean, when the breach happened and when it became news, obviously you're suddenly going to be getting a huge amount of traffic and requests to the site. Mm. I mean, it was this the most traffic you've had on that site to date?
Yeah, it was. Now, look, I mean, I go through periods of high loads of traffic for various reasons. So one reason is there's a breach that hits the news, and whether I have the data or not, people seem to like to come to the site and search for it. So there is organic traffic driven by a particular media event, which is one. The other is that I have an API, and people often scan the database using the API. And that means that frequently I'll see my requests sitting at a steady sort of some number of hundreds per minute, and then suddenly go up to tens of thousands per minute. And it will just, you know, literally in the space of a minute go to that scale. So I see that kind of load a lot. The difference with the organic load is when you have organic load, it's very unpredictable. So it is people loading web pages, which then have various assets, which also need to get loaded. It's not just sort of hitting one API endpoint that's nice and light. They're loading images and style sheets and all sorts of other things as well. And it's very up and down. And it can ramp up significantly higher than what someone is able to send via API requests, because at the end of the day, if you've got millions of people distributed around the world, that is a very different load profile and potentially a significantly higher load profile than one person in one organization trying to make as many requests as they can through their pipe.
Yeah, so again, I think the amazing thing is, obviously, it was the Ashley Madison stuff when it happened. Was the load greater than what you've seen before, or was it noticeably more, or was it, you know, 10%, 20%? I mean, basically, I suppose what I'm asking is when, you know, it happened, were you able, did you actually see, did you were notified, did you, you know, see that something's going on here? Have you got that sort of metric set up?
Yeah, so I have got an enormous amount of metrics. And if anyone's interested in this, if you go to my blog there, or if you Google me, there is a blog post called How Did Have I Been Pwned Perform on Azure and Ashley Madison Retrospective? And I'll give you some of the figures, because I publish everything pretty publicly. So, yeah, one figure here is that I saw my sessions peak at about 55,500 simultaneous, or rather sessions for the hour. So this was 20th of August 2015 at 11 a.m. So, yeah, about almost 56,000 sessions in that 1 hour, which was kind of interesting because it had been literally only 24 hours earlier than that. And the sort of the headline figure there was that the scale jumped about 58,000% in just over 24 hours. So that's something which is just a perfect illustration of why you need this sort of elastic scale that we talk about with cloud services like Azure. So imagine that your traffic goes up 58,000%. How are you going to handle that without either paying a lot of money for services you don't need at the beginning of that load period when it's very, very small, or not having enough when it actually goes through the roof? So that was one headline figure. And then I guess the other ones, and I'm flicking through this now, and this is all according to Google Analytics as well. These figures are according to Google Analytics. And of course, some people block it. So I find that the actual figures are normally about 20% higher. I think that the busiest period I saw whilst I was actively monitoring it was about 4,500 active users on the site at once. So it's probably more like about 5,500. So that's actual people on the site clicking around at that time, which was kind of interesting. And yeah, they're sort of the big figures that jump out at me. There's a lot of other data here that I've shared from my New Relic Analytics as well, if people are interested, about how response times and things were going. So there's a lot of data there. And I think that there is more figures and information there than what people will be willing to consume. So go and check that out if you're interested.
It's certainly a very extensive blog post, and again, but it is very interesting. Now, you talk about the scalability and the elasticity. Did you have the service set up to automatically scale, which you can do in Azure, or did you have to go in and manually push some buttons and, you know, take it up to the next level when you saw this sort of level of demand?
Yeah, so this is one of the tricks that I learned very early on, and in Troy's book of scaling tricks, one of the things that I would suggest is to always enable auto-scale to go as far out as possible. Now, one thing I should clarify here as well is that I'm talking about PaaS. So I'm talking about Azure websites or web applications, as I now call them, a platform as a service. So this is not me having infrastructure as a service in my own VM that I can, you know, control and manage and take responsibility for. This is the managed service. And what you can do with Azure web applications is you can auto scale out. And what you can scale to is, by default, you can scale out to 10 instances on their standard implementation. There's now a higher tier implementation that will scale out beyond that, which has only just recently been introduced. But I had it set at up to 10 instances. And I actually learned very early on to set that very high, because if you don't, you might lose traffic. And this happened to me, because very early on I went, okay, well, look, I will auto scale out to 3 because I'm scared of paying too much money. And that was sort of my very unqualified gut reaction a couple of years ago. And what I found was that things happen overnight, because in Australia, everything interesting always happens overnight because it's business hours in the US. And I woke up and I'd lost traffic because I'd scaled out to 3 instances and I'd overwhelmed 3 instances. And the funny thing is that when you actually look at the costs, and keeping in mind that Azure web applications are billed per minute, the cost of scaling out, even all the way to 10 instances, it is nothing for small amounts of time. You know, I mean, 10 instances for a day, I guess it's like 10 days of normal traffic with one instance. And most of the time, you don't think too much about that cost. So scale out, absolute maxed out. Now, the other one is, and just to clarify again, that does happen automatically. And you can set triggers for what causes that scale out to happen. So you can set things like the HTTP response queue or the CPU utilization. And the trick is to play around with those triggers until you find the sweet spot. So that's scaling out. Now, scaling up, of course, is the other dimension. So what size infrastructure do you have, which you may then have multiple copies of? So do you have, it used to be small, medium, large, it's now S1, S2, S3, and each level increases the number of CPUs by 2 and the amount of RAM by 2, and it increases the cost by 2. So one thing that I did some time ago now is I moved from sort of the entry level up to the medium tier, where you actually have two CPUs, which makes very quite a lot of difference in terms of the performance of the application, even under very, very light load. So I always had sort of a middle of the road tier there. But when I saw Ashley Madison starting to go nuts, I manually scaled that up to one large instance because I knew that I was going to need multiple instances. And by going large, I basically bought myself some insurance. And yes, I paid more for it, but the scale happens automatically without any loss of out time once you actually dial it in the portal. And I figured, look, I'll just run it this way for a day. And if I get up in the morning and it's using like two large instances and it hasn't gone too crazy, then I'll just dial it back to medium. And maybe then I'll have four medium instances. And at least then when it goes all the way back to one, I won't be paying large scale money for a medium instance.
Yeah, so I think that the big point here, I think, is the you know, which many people don't realize, especially with the PaaS offering, is that, you know, auto scalability. So you can scale based on, like I said, CPU. You can, you know, have a different arrangement for weekends and weekdays and weeknights. And it's really getting to this point with these sort of services that you're only paying, like I said, by the minute for exactly what you need. And again, you can set it to auto, do a lot of stuff. But obviously, you can go in and tweak it as you did to get that sort of, you know, that sweet spot. And you can cope with these, you know, massive situations that you could never perhaps, you know, foresee. So I mean, if it was an e-commerce site and all that, you know, like, you know, they're selling maybe, you know, Teletubbies or something, and suddenly they become the talk of the town, everybody jumps on that. Like I said, you don't want to have the situation where you're missing out sales, you're missing out converting those into dollars without having the infrastructure to do it. So there's just no way that I could see that you could provide that sort of service with on-premise equipment. And also, again, all of these things that are built into the Azure side of things and give you just that flexibility. I think that's the amazing thing that so many people just don't appreciate with a tool or with a service like Azure.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole idea of you know, it's funny, I just can't even envisage now thinking about on-prem again. And that goes from the, you know, the my recent life in corporate world as well. Just having moved past that, to think about having to go back to that, it hurts to think about it.
You know? Well, I think the interesting thing is, if you look at the summary of that blog post that we talked about here, and I'll just read this. It's got, over these three crazy days, have I been pwned on Azure? So 4 million page views and up to 10,000 simultaneous users querying 220 million records at an average of 41 milliseconds. And this is the best part for me, is like, it cost you a total of $130 and 100% uptime. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, so they're the other headline figures. That was my grand finale, but you know, now that you've mentioned it, yeah, so,
well, you know,
that was the really interesting thing, because while this was all scaling out, and what a lot of people don't know is that this happened whilst I was away snowboarding as well. So I was with my family, and the idea was to have a holiday, and of course this happened while I was away. So I was like sitting on the chairlift with my iPhone RDPing in and sort of, you know, trying to remotely manage these sessions, which was kind of interesting. But I hadn't sort of given a lot of thought to the cost. I went, look, just make it work. And part of the reason I hadn't given a lot of thought to the cost is I was getting a lot of donations at the time. So I have a donate facility on the website. And I thought, you know, look, I'll get some money and it will, you know, cover it. Maybe it will even cost $1,000 or $2,000. And I'd get the donations to cover it with that amount of traffic. And I was really shocked when I actually did the numbers for this blog post. I went, oh man, like, why is that so low? You know, have I got this right? And a lot of it came down to the fact that, you know, for things like that medium instance or an S2 standard instance, as they call it now, it is 20 cents an hour. I just pulled the figures up again just to be sure. So, you know, when I had to have 10 of these guys running at the same time, that is $2 an hour worth of simultaneous instances running. And that just blows me away. Like, I cannot buy a coffee here for $2. Like, that's crazy. But I can run 10 servers for an hour for that amount of money. So that kept the cost really, really, really low. And of course, as soon as the traffic backed off a little bit, the instances would be taken away. And then you're paying 1/60th of 20 cents. So what are we looking at there? Like a third of a cent. You're paying a third of a cent per minute. And it will shut down the minute it's no longer needed, once the trigger thresholds are hit. And that cost goes away. So that's what kept it down so low. And the other interesting thing about it is, when I looked at the way the instances were distributed, and I show the graphs in the post, I went, well, I've actually got too many. I'm actually paying too much money. And that was really curious, because I could have got the cost down further. But because I always had so much in terms of resources, that's what ultimately got me 100.00% uptime. And when I got the weekly New Relic email the following Monday, they send it out each Monday, I went, oh man, look at this. Like, I actually did not lose any traffic. That is crazy. So, you know, to be able to get, you know, this is not even five nines. Like, this is 100% absolute support and availability for 130 something bucks. That still just blows me away just thinking about it.
Well, again, that's the whole point. Again, recommend that people read the blog post and understand. I mean, the underlying technology here, again, to move to that level of reliability, to move to that level of scalability, to handle that, you know, out of the blue request, and then to cost, you know, like I said, you know, that amount of money, is just mind blowing. Again, it's sort of one of those, I think, reinforcing instances where it says, you know, this is why we're moving to the cloud technology. This is why things like Azure make sense. This is why doing things in the PaaS environment just makes so much sense, because, again, you know, with more and more stuff moving to the web and dealing with this, and again, the results, you know, and the documentation you provided just prove it down to a T how powerful this is. And on the other side, how cheap it is. I mean, how, you know, anybody, SMB, small businesses, one-man bands, can be utilizing this and getting such effective results with such potential computing power at their fingertips. And that really, I think, should make people sit up and take notice and really question a lot of the stuff as, hang on, you know, why are we doing things this way, or why are we accepting these sort of costs when we can get into this sort of environment? So I think, again, absolutely amazing technical result when you've gone through all the analysis. And again, recommend people to certainly dive in and read that blog post. So it is amazing.
So we should actually talk about some of the bad bits as well, because otherwise we sound like two Microsoft MVPs talking about how awesome everything is. And one of the things that comes to mind, and this is not a bad bit per se, but it's taken me quite a bit of time to really understand how to use cloud paradigms in the right way. And I'll give you an example of this. So I use a construct called table storage. So within the storage paradigm, there are things like blobs and queues and files and tables. And tables are effectively key value store. So you can put in a particular key, and you define a partition and a row key, and then you can put in some text. So it could be a blob of JSON, for example. And the reason I use table storage is it is enormously cheap and enormously fast. And what I mean by that is, I think in my figures, I showed it works out at something, you know, for about 222 million records and many, many, many millions of queries per month, it's like $2 a month. It is ridiculously cheap. And it is very, very fast to look things up by key. And it's very, very slow to query by anything other than just looking up by a key. And I had a bit of a backwards and forwards. I ended up writing a blog post about this. In fact, the blog post I wrote, I think I said something like, supercars suck at transporting TVs, and blob storage is it sucks at doing queries. And basically, this was in reaction to someone who I know online, actually, saying that their experience with Azure had been terrible. They were very unhappy with it. And basically what the guy was trying to do is he was trying to use table storage to run these ad hoc queries. He wasn't just trying to use it in the way it had been intended to work, which is to query by a key. And the analogy in the blog post was, I had at one stage tried to fit a TV into my Nissan GTR, and it was terrible. And you would have looked at it and gone, man, this car sucks. This is useless. You can't even fit a TV into it. Yes, it'll do 320k an hour, but I can't fit a TV because it was not fit for purpose. And what I'm finding with these cloud paradigms is that it is really easy to use them the wrong way and to conclude that they suck. And it does take quite a bit of effort to sort of wrap your head around how to tie all these bits together. So I use this table storage paradigm, but I also use queue storage because I have message queues, and I also use a relational database. And very often we think about building applications in that it will have a data store of this type. And we don't generally tend to think about, well, maybe I should have multiple data repositories of different types that do various things well, not just to save costs, but to make it fast. I couldn't make it this fast with a SQL back end and not totally blow my budget out by a factor of many, many hundreds, if not thousands of percent. But I do use a relational database for smaller volumes of data that do actually need to be queried in the way that relational databases work very well. And I actually pay significantly more money for the relational database than what I do for the table storage, even though there's only a small fraction of the data.
Yeah, so I think you're right. I think in a lot of cases, what people underestimate are two things. Is obviously Azure is not just one product. It's not just one service. It's so much more than that. And I think especially for people coming from the smaller environments, the SMB side, it's very difficult to know where to start, how to do this. It is very enterprise and developer focused, so that does put people off. But again, I still come back to the fact that back in the days, learning Windows Server, learning Exchange Server still required a significant investment in time and effort. And it's not as though the resources aren't there, but I agree with you. At the end of the day, you do need to sit down and start, learning this. And obviously, the stuff that you're creating, the Pluralsight stuff is a great place, the Microsoft Virtual Academy, there's lots of this stuff, but you do need to put the time into it. And then, obviously, once you've got the basics to really optimize it, as with all technology, you do need to spend the time in. Because as you said, it's so easy to click a few buttons and do a couple of basic things and end up with everything incorrectly configured or with, the wrong optimization options provided. So certainly, yeah, I agree with you that they are the real challenges. But this is now, it's so much easier to work with. It's so much easier to get your hands dirty. I think the real trick is most people look at it and sort of say, okay, I want to learn Azure, right? So they go off and read the documentation. I think the lesson here, and the lesson I also found, was that if you've got a project you want to solve, in your case it was, have I been pwned? For me it was migrating SharePoint servers. That was the project that I could then throw myself into and wrap Azure around, and that's when you get that moment of, oh, okay. So I think that's the differentiation here. It's about of what's the project or what can I solve potentially using Azure to learn on the back end, rather than just saying, look, I want to learn it. Where's the 101 course?
Yeah, look, I totally agree with that. And again, that was part of the reason I wanted to do Have I Been Pwned, not just because I think it's a good service, but because it gives me that Azure experience. And I was doing increasingly getting involved with Azure in my corporate life as well. And the amount I learned from building this project was just so far above and beyond what I would learn just from reading content online. And I mean, I say this having actually created a Pluralsight course on how to build services like Have I Been Pwned with Azure. But I think it's really important to be able to demonstrate that. And look, you can sort of take this in little bites as well, right? Because the nice thing about cloud services is that you can just say, look, I just want to do this little piece or that little piece, or I just want to use, I had a little project recently where we decided just to use blob storage. So we needed to create sort of a file sharing implementation. Well, we'll just use the blob storage, put a toe in the water, see how it feels. So taking little bites like that is a good idea. So if you're thinking about moving into the cloud, I'd suggest that. Try and find something small that might only use one part of the service. And at least that gets you familiar with the portal and the billing and the way the implementation actually works. And then that's knowledge, which it's a much smaller leap when you then go on to the next thing, which might be holistically a larger project, but you've already got that familiarity with the platform.
Yeah, and I think that's a secret to it. I mean, if you're a Microsoft partner, you certainly get generally get a number of free credits which allow you to fiddle around. There's generally a good thing to start is Azure backups, and you can have virtual machines. Mm. But the good thing now is you can expand into, like I said, if you want to get into development, you've got the website, you've also got the Visual Studio, you've got the mobile apps, you've got machine learning, you've got all of these opportunities that weren't available before. And the good thing is the enablement it provides for, you know, the one-man band, the small operator like me to, you know, the big multi-enterprise environments. Again, I think Azure is one of those key skills that IT professionals certainly need to have some knowledge about, and if they don't, they certainly need to look at buddying up to people that do have that sort of knowledge as well, because I think it's just such a key. And I think the other thing that's really interesting about it is just the tear that it's on, the amount of stuff they're adding, and then especially around what I've been watching lately is the Azure AD stuff and bringing in group policy and all this stuff coming into preview. Now they've really got their underlying foundation, and they can start layering on these services on top. So again, another big benefit of the cloud, and I think again the message hopefully is that have a project, simple, the simpler the better, probably bring it in, get it going, and you'll certainly understand Azure and learn it and then be able to apply it and add that skill set to your own job, your customers, or your employer as well. So I think that's really interesting. Now, before we sort of head off and finish up and let Troy get away and do what he normally does every day, the other thing that really interested me again in this was not the technology side. So again, Troy wrote a blog post on sort of the human impact, the impact that it had, that I don't think reading through the blog post and following that was something that really sort of surprised you, wasn't it? This sort of personal interaction of people who had been affected by the Ashley Madison breach coming sort of to you looking for some sort of advice. Do you want to give us a bit of a background on sort of that aspect of it as well? So I've talked about the technology, but what about the human aspect here that you did again blog quite extensively on?
Well, this was really interesting, and I don't think we often think about our users in this way. And basically what happened was after I wrote about the incident. In fact, I wrote about it after the announcement was first made that the system had been compromised, but the data hadn't been leaked. And I sort of wrote about how I was going to handle it if it was leaked, and I made the decision not to make it publicly searchable, which was the main takeaway from that. And then after I did make the data available and have I been pwned to people that could verify they owned the address I was searching for, I started getting a lot of questions, coming to me privately, not from technology people, but from people that had been impacted by the breach. So I wrote up a Q&A site, because what was happening was that people were asking me things of a very personal nature. Can you find out precisely what data was leaked about me? Now, beyond the sort of ethical issues of doing that, there was a flood of requests I just couldn't handle. So I started adding to this Q&A blog post and then just saying, look, I'm sorry I can't answer you personally, go and read it here. And increasingly, the questions and the feedback from people was of a really sensitive nature. So for example, there would be women who said, look, we were on the site and they were there not because they wanted to have an affair, but because they were worried their husbands were. So they would create an account and in some cases catch the husband having an affair, then get divorced, and then some years later now be in this breach and effectively implicated as an adulterer. And they may well have moved on in life. They may have a new partner now as well. And their presence there obviously doesn't look real good for them. So I was getting really, really sensitive emails like that. And I started collecting some of them and obviously rather anonymized them and put them in a blog post, something along the lines of, here's what Ashley Madison customers have told me.
Yep, so the 24th of August you published that.
Right, and it is just... Yeah, like some of it is almost gets a bit heart-wrenching, you know, guys saying, kiss your kids and your wife goodnight tonight, I'll do the same for mine because I don't think I'm going to be able to see them for very long. Emails about people who are contemplating suicide. And, you know, that to me, on the one hand, obviously struck a real sort of emotional chord. And to be honest, I became a little bit numb to it because it was, there's just so much of it. But on the other hand, it made me really think, you know, how often do we think about the impact of our systems on individuals? and particularly the impact of data breaches. I mean, we go through sort of threat modeling and decide how we're going to implement security controls, but we rarely think, you know, is there maybe going to be a guy sitting at home in his living room as a result of this, you know, wanting to take a few too many sleeping tablets? And this is what that incident eventually got to. And yeah, for anyone listening, I think it's really interesting to read that just to sort of put into context the responsibility we take on when we build systems, and just to sort of get you thinking a little bit about the fact that there are, you know, there are humans at the other end using them. And it almost sounds like a flippant thing to say because we know that, but it's very different when you actually hear their stories.
Yeah, I, again, if you look through the blog post, again, fantastic blog post, plenty of really interesting information here. But, you know, the one that, some of the ones you like is what I've, again, as a technology person living with technology, understanding technology, using it every day, it's second nature. But you get, I said, the summary request you've got here is like, please erase me from the internet. It's like, surely everybody understands that simply not possible anymore. But, again, it that's that sort of worry. It's again, you have people who are using these services, taking advantage of them, and I mean, probably on the security side as well, but they really don't understand what they're letting themselves in for or what terms and conditions they're accepting. And again, if things go pear-shaped, if their data does escape, the ramifications that can have financially, emotionally, as you've got in here. So I think that's, again, a great post for people to go in and have a look at. And again, as you mentioned, there is the impact that what seems like just a technology solution, and again, once you get to scale, once you get to, you know, tens of thousands of users, the impact is dramatic. Again, that's the big thing here, that's, again, the scale here, because of the size of the internet and this sort of service, I think that's where the biggest impact is that, you know, half a dozen users, yeah, okay, but the numbers just, again, are so frightening when the majority of them just haven't got that basic understanding.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to be fair, I don't understand the terms and conditions of things I sign up to because I don't read them, because nobody reads them, and they're not for us, they're for lawyers. And you know, that in itself is sort of interesting. It's kind of the way the internet's become, I guess. But the innocence of people making the assumption that the representations of the website will actually be upheld, and particularly for Ashley Madison, their representation was discretion. And their site still says that. It's still 100% discreet. They've still got the damn logo on the page, which absolutely blows me away. And that is what people believed they would get when they signed up to it. And interestingly, just only about an hour ago, I was having a chat with someone from Telstra about the security of one of their products. And it was the usual. We take it very seriously. We've put a lot of effort into it. And yes, I know these websites do, and they always believe they're doing the right thing. But unfortunately, you always have to work on the assumption now that the worst case scenario will happen to the device or the service or whatever it is that you're using. And when we're talking about this sort of information, it means that people unfortunately have to take a little bit more care. Maybe don't sign up to that adultery website with your work email address. You know, maybe make an obfuscated Gmail account. But people just don't tend to think that way. Not for the most part.
Again, it's very interesting, and I think one of the things we've seen in Australia recently, which again just is sort of, you know, seems to have floated by most people, is the new metadata legislation, so that requires ISPs and that to create capture metadata about usage on the internet, phone calls. And again, people just don't appreciate that, again, using something like Azure, the massive computing, the ability to aggregate this data and then start looking at patterns, as you mentioned right up front about the Have I Been Pwned site. It's like, okay, that's interesting. We've got a hit over here and this matches a thing over here, and you could never do that before. And that's why stuff like metadata now is so important or so useful to organisations are looking to monitor people, because it just wasn't available before. And unfortunately, it's a factor of today's world. So again, part of the advice probably is to get in there, understand it, appreciate it, learn about the technologies a bit, and generally, I suppose be a bit cautious and think before you go and sign up to all these things and throw your normal work email address at all these sort of e-commerce sites and other things that you used to like signing up for.
Yep, wise words. I can't argue with any of that.
All right, so what I think we better do is obviously let Troy get on with the rest of his day, but what I'll get him to do is maybe just give us a bit of a summary, a bit of a overall picture of what we've talked about, and then let everybody know how they can keep in contact with Troy, follow what he's doing, and learn more about, you know, the products that he's using every day.
Cool. All right. Well, that sounds great. And look, it's always been good talking. If there's any other links or resources or things like that, I'll flick those through to you. And of course, the main way that people can get in touch with me is troyhunt.com or on Twitter as Troy Hunt.
Cool. Well, I think, again, I'll make sure that I put the links to the two blog posts we've mentioned here, but certainly recommend you set aside some time. Again, Troy's blog posts seem generally very extensive. No matter what he writes about, they are exactly normally a long one. The question is how long does it take to write some of these, Troy? It must take you hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, look, it depends what it is. And sometimes I just get I get a beat in my bonnet. Yeah. Well, either that or you get into the zone, it sort of runs away. But I often say to people, I don't write these posts for you, I write them for me, because when I write these, they solidify things in my mind. And I wanted to write that one in detail about the performance, because going through and writing about it forced me to analyze things very carefully, and I made a bunch of improvements as a result of that.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. I certainly agree, and that's what I like doing about the blog too. For me, it's solidifying my thought and putting it in a logical sequence. The other side of the coin is it's a reference for me to be able to go and search and look up and find the information when I need it, because, again, it's on the web. So, again, certainly point people to troyhunt.com, and we'll put the links to the specific posts in there. So recommend you go and read both of those. But with that, I will take the opportunity again to thank Troy for his time today, the information, and obviously the hard work that he puts in making this information available to everybody. And again, recommend that they certainly do follow the stuff that he does, because again, lots and lots of very, very interesting stuff on Azure security. So again, a highly recommended site for you to follow.
Thanks very much, mate.
All right, no worries. Well, with that, thank you very much, everybody, for listening. You can catch up with me on the Twitter at DirectorCIA and on my blog, blog.ciaops.com. But with that, I think we're done for another episode. Thank you very much for listening, and stay tuned for future editions of the Need to Know podcast.
You've been listening to the Need to Know podcast with Robert Crane from CIA Ops. For guides on using technologies like SharePoint and Office 365, visit www.ciaops.com/publications. You can directly support this podcast by purchasing guides from the selection available. You'll also find templates there to use on your own SharePoint site to help your business get up to speed quickly. Reseller options are also available. All of this can be downloaded immediately from www.ciaops.com/publications. To provide feedback on this episode or to make any comments, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.